Lecture 74, The New Frontier and the Great Society.
Last time we saw how the civil rights movement made vital gains in the 1960s. And now in this lecture, I'm going to say a little more about the era's liberal governments, which we remember as the New Frontier and the Great Society. Youthful, handsome President Kennedy brought charisma to the White House in 1961. His election also showed that a Roman Catholic could win the nation's highest office and contributed to a decline in interreligious tensions in America. Kennedy's escalation of the Cold War, apparent in the Bay of Pigs invasion, the Cuba Missile Crisis, and the expansion of America's role in Vietnam, was offset by a new concern for legislating on behalf of the poor and minorities. After his assassination in 1963, about which certain mysteries have never been adequately resolved, his successor, Lyndon Johnson, pursued similar policies more aggressively. Johnson's sweeping anti-poverty, anti-discrimination legislation, remembered collectively as the Great Society, marked another step in the expansion of the federal government. Despite continued economic boom conditions, however, the nation experienced severe urban rioting among the poorest sections of the population, and the riots severely damaged the social optimism that had been generated by the civil rights movement's success. Kennedy's family history and his personal attributes made him an attractive candidate and president. His father, descendant of Irish immigrants, was a very wealthy man and very ambitious on his own behalf and on behalf of his sons. This is Joe Kennedy. He profited from the liquor business in the 1920s and 30s, before and after Prohibition. He was a very successful Wall Street investor in the 20s and became one of the important owners of the Hollywood movie studios in the 1930s. And he wrangled from President Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, appointment as America's ambassador to Great Britain at the start of the Second World War. And watching what was happening during Hitler's great early successes, became convinced that Britain was going to lose. Well, Joe Kennedy schemed to make his oldest son president of the United States. His oldest son was Joseph Jr. But during the war, Joe Jr. was killed in a plane crash. He was part of the American military. And so then the younger son, John F. Kennedy, became the focus of the father's ambitions. And Joe Kennedy said at one point, "We're going to sell him like soap flakes." He understood the enormous importance of money and publicity and placing the candidate just right. Well, sure enough, John F. Kennedy did make rapid political gains. He was a freshman in Congress in 1946, one of a great generation of people who went into Congress after being demobilized from the military. And he had the advantage of a distinguished war record, so that he was able to make rapid progress through the ranks of the Democrats. In fact, he was the first of the lower ranks World War II veterans to reach the White House. Obviously, his predecessor, Eisenhower, had been a general, whereas Kennedy himself had been a junior officer. And in fact, throughout the late 40s, the 50s, 60s and 70s, to have a good World War II record was highly desirable for any political candidate. His adventures in PT-109, the boat he'd captained during the war, was the basis of a book in 1961 by R.J. Donovan. It's called PT-109. And in 1963, a film was made from the book starring Cliff Robertson as Kennedy. What happened was that during the Battle of the Solomon Islands in the Pacific, Kennedy's boat was rammed and sunk by a Japanese destroyer. It is, in fact, a very dramatic story. While he was making his way up through the Democratic Party ranks in the mid-50s, he also published a book called Profiles in Courage, published in 56, and it won the Pulitzer Prize. Although it wasn't really Kennedy who wrote it, it was one of his aides. Like most politicians' books, someone else writes it, even if the politician himself takes credit for it. But the historian David Shy says that D.C. Washington critics at the time said he was showing more profile than courage in his campaigns, especially during the McCarthy era, when he made no attempt to denounce or distance himself from McCarthyism. Well, he became, after 3 terms in the House of Representatives, he became the junior Massachusetts senator in 1952. The next year, 53, he married Jacqueline Bouvier, an elegant, beautifully, and very, very politically accomplished young woman from another political family of Massachusetts. And she, like Eleanor Roosevelt before her, had to tolerate her husband's philandering. Today, Kennedy would have been in the same kind of trouble as Clinton was, or worse. But the press turned a blind eye to Kennedy's sexual affairs, just as it had turned a blind eye to Roosevelt's, and also had covered up the fact of Roosevelt's polio. Those were days when the press was far more subservient to the White House's demands. Kennedy, in fact, had been severely injured during the war and suffered a range of illnesses, Addison's disease, severe back pains, bouts of venereal disease and so on, but was capable, he took a lot of medication, but was capable of disguising from the public the fact that he was suffering. His presidential campaign in 1960 led to one of the very narrowest victories in American history. In the preceding two campaigns, 52 and 56, Dwight Eisenhower, the war hero, had been the successful Republican candidate. And the loser of both those elections had been Adlai Stevenson, from Illinois, one of the wittiest candidates in American history, but not able to oust a great national hero. The great problem for Kennedy was overcoming the Catholic factor. He and his advisors were fully aware that Al Smith had lost severely in 1928, and that America had never had a Catholic president. And they understandably worried about whether they were going to be able to overcome what looked like a rather severe obstacle. An organization called Protestants and Other Americans United for Separation of Church and State declared that it was incompatible with American traditions to have a Catholic in the White House because he was going to take instruction from the Pope and therefore couldn't be a free agent in making up his mind politically. And many notable figures of the day had the same view. Billy Graham, who already in the 50s was probably the most famous preacher in America. The Episcopal Bishop of San Francisco, Bishop Pike. Paul Blanchard, who wrote a book called American Freedom and Catholic Power, in which he said, really, the Catholic Church is a little bit reminiscent of the communists. It's a mind control organization. And of course, in the 50s, that was the most damning comparison you could possibly make. Norman Vincent Peale, whose book How to Win Friends and Influence People was a massive bestseller of the 50s. He was a Protestant minister too and said, we should not have a Catholic in the White House. So a widespread agreement that Kennedy's religion was a genuine obstacle, even though for far more than a century, Catholics had sat in Congress, had sat in the Senate, had been state governors, mayors, Supreme Court justices. In every other way, they'd played an active part in America's political life, without showing much sign of deference to the Pope. Well, in the end, what Kennedy's advisors did was to get John Courtney Murray, who was an important Jesuit intellectual, to write a speech for Kennedy on the ways in which he distinguished between religious and political affairs. And he delivered it to the Houston Ministerial Association in the run-up to the 1960 election, a gathering of evangelical clergy. And the central point of this speech was that if it ever came to the point where Kennedy found an absolute contradiction between his faith and his policy intentions, he'd resign. But he added, I expect that any president would resign if he was unable to carry out the national policy without violating his conscience. In other words, admitting, yes, there are certain points on which I wouldn't compromise, but yes, that's also true of every other candidate. Actually, of course, Kennedy wasn't a very good Catholic at all, and sometimes he used to say to his advisors, it's so unreasonable for them to make a fuss about me as a Catholic, because I'm not really a very good one. Certainly he knew all about sin. Well, during his presidency, in fact, starting in the fall of 1962, a great change began in the public image of the Catholic Church in America. It had always had a reputation for being uncompromising and inflexible. But in 1962, Pope John XXIII called to the Vatican the world's bishops for the Second Vatican Council. And between then and 1965, the Second Vatican Council reinterpreted or redefined many of their principles. And from the American point of view, one of the most important new emphases was on interreligious harmony. Instead of regarding Protestants as heretics, as they always had done until now, they started to reinterpret Protestantism. The name now was the Separated Brethren, a much more conciliatory way of thinking about the Protestants. So anti-Catholicism, which had been a very, very sharp and real force throughout most of American history, began to decline rapidly in the 1960s, partly because there was now a Catholic president, and partly because the Vatican Council was being so conciliatory. Well, in the run-up to the election, not only did Kennedy have to deal with the Catholic question, of course he also had to defeat his Republican rival. And this was the sitting vice president, Richard Nixon, who'd been Eisenhower's vice president through the previous two terms. And the debate was broadcast on television and on radio. Kennedy, a handsome man, was the more telegenic. By comparison, Nixon looked shifty and not very well. He had a very heavy beard, and he seemed to have a sort of 5 o'clock shadow as he debated. He already had the reputation of, one of his nicknames was Tricky Dick. He'd had the reputation of being the tough guy in the White House, the enforcer, who enabled Eisenhower to rise above the fray. But it's interesting that people who watched the debate on TV thought that Kennedy had won, whereas those who heard it on the radio thought that Nixon had won in terms of the actual substance of the issues debated. Well, when the election actually took place, it was extremely close. Nixon won more states, but lost the overall vote by 118,000 votes and lost narrowly in the Electoral College. There were stories that Joe Kennedy, John F. Kennedy's father, who was a crony of the Chicago political boss, Richard Daley, they'd made an arrangement to be certain that Illinois would go the way it needed to go in order to ensure Kennedy's victory. Some of Nixon's advisors actually encouraged him to challenge the election and demand a recount. But Nixon himself said the instability which would ensue would be alarming to the nation as a whole. And so Nixon accepted the verdict with regret. The Kennedy administration, coming into office in early 61, believed in a more aggressive pursuit of the Cold War than had Eisenhower. One of Kennedy's campaign arguments was that there was a growing missile gap. In other words, that the Soviet Union was getting more intercontinental missiles than the Americans were, and therefore America was becoming a little bit vulnerable in its nuclear defenses. And Kennedy made the claim that Eisenhower had been a little bit too passive in accepting that the Cold War was a stalemate, a standoff in which neither side could make effective gains against the other. Kennedy's alternative policy was called flexible response. And he said, we've got to engage the enemy more accurately. Even though we can't do it in Central Europe, the prospective great battleground of a major war, we've got to fight the brushfire wars around the periphery more energetically. And he supported an energetic, vigorous anti-communist action in Vietnam, which I'll talk about a couple of lectures from now, but which already was very much on everybody's radar screens. Just before he came into office, the Cuban Revolution had succeeded under the leadership of Fidel Castro. With the help of Che Guevara and a guerrilla band in the Cuban forests, he'd ousted the American-backed regime of Batista. Cuban exiles, refugees, flocked to Florida and planned a counter-invasion to try to seize Cuba back again from the Castro regime, which very quickly identified itself with the Soviet Union. And an invasion of these exiles was launched at the Bay of Pigs. Very, very quickly, the invasion force was, although it had clearly been given American aid, first under Eisenhower, then under Kennedy, and the invasion had been launched from the United States, it wasn't very long before Castro's forces were overwhelming it. Kennedy could have provided air support and could have provided direct military support, but drew back from doing so, with the result that the Bay of Pigs invasion was a failure. About 1,200 of the invaders were captured, and within 3 days, the whole thing was over, a failure. American complicity with the invasion to begin with, followed by its failure to back it up with air support, made America look weak. And because public relations were such an important part of the Cold War and giving the appearance of strength and resolution. Kennedy felt that that had been a rather severe dent to his authority and prestige as a president. And he certainly attempted to regain the initiative in the Cuban Missile Crisis of the next year, 1962. Once Cuba had become a Soviet satellite, once Castro had accepted the benefits of aid from Khrushchev, the Soviet leader, he also had to inherit some of the downside. Khrushchev wanted to establish a set of missile bases in Cuba and sent ships bearing these missiles in October 1962 to land in Cuba where the bases could be established, only about 90 miles from the American mainland. Well, Kennedy sent the United States Navy and drew a quarantine line, in other words, an imaginary line in the ocean, saying, the Soviet ships carrying these missiles must not go beyond this point. At first, the ships kept going towards the line, and this was one of the moments when the entire world appeared to be stepping towards the brink of a major conflict between the two great superpowers. But the prospect of war led Khrushchev to back down. Calmer relations prevailed after that. And in fact, America, which had got its own missiles very close to Soviet territory in Turkey, America withdrew those missiles from Turkey as a quid pro quo for the Russian agreement not to force the issue in establishing its own missiles there in Cuba. And it was the next summer, the summer of 63, that the Atmospheric Test Ban Treaty was negotiated, which prevented the testing of nuclear weapons in the open air. In his domestic policies, Kennedy took limited initiatives on behalf of women and minorities and the poor. But his progress was inhibited by the very narrow margin of victory he'd enjoyed in 1960, and also by the power of Southern white Democrats in Congress. He was very anxious lest he alienate people who were one of his power bases, because he was thinking ahead to the election of 1964 and fearing that he might not be able to retain the solid South if he made too many concessions in civil rights, a point we raised previously. He created a commission on the status of women. He raised the minimum wage. He began some initiatives to create low-cost housing for poor Americans. And he did become progressively more sympathetic to the civil rights movement as segregationist violence intensified, especially after the summer of 1963. The Attorney General, his brother Robert Kennedy, I mentioned previously, was more enthusiastic about civil rights than the president himself. When a black student tried to enroll at the University of Mississippi, this was James Meredith, who became one of the pioneers of higher education desegregation. Robert Kennedy sent federal marshals to the campus, Ole Miss. They were attacked. And finally, he sent federal troops as well. Robert Kennedy was more attuned to the magnitude of the movement than the president. But of course, as we know, the question of the election of 64 was entirely beside the point, because Kennedy was assassinated in November 1963 during a visit to Dallas. Every president elected in a year ending in zero since 1840 had died in office. Of course, this doesn't mean that that was the cause of their death, but it is a fascinating coincidence. The presidents elected in 1860, 80, and 1900 had all been assassinated, and the presidents elected in 1920, 1840, 1920, and 1940 had all died in office. And here it happened once again. A lot of mystery surrounds the incident of Kennedy's assassination. Was Lee Harvey Oswald alone in shooting from the Dallas Book Depository? Was there a man nearby on the grassy knoll? Does the Zapruder film of the actual event support the theory of multiple assassins? Well, Earl Warren, who was the Supreme Court Justice, led a commission, the Warren Commission, which attempted to sort out all the issues in the following years. But although it wrote a massive report, in many people's view, it intensified the mystery rather than resolving it. This is perhaps particularly true because Jack Ruby shot Lee Harvey Oswald before he could tell the full story, and that deepened the uncertainties. Was he connected with the Soviet Union? Was he connected with the Cubans? Was he connected with the Mafia? And so on. There are dozens of questions never fully resolved. But it's certainly true that hundreds of conspiracy theorists have gathered around the incident, and some of their explanations of the assassination are wild flights of fancy. I think this is one of those places where we've got to be historical agnostics. We've got to admit that we just don't know. Well, Kennedy's good looks, his charismatic personality, the mystique of his turning the White House into something like Camelot. This was one of the Kennedy's favourite musicals was Camelot, and the idea that they'd borrowed some of the prestige of old King Arthur's court came in. All this, plus his sudden untimely death, turned him into a larger-than-life figure. Poets and classical musicians performed at the White House. The best and the brightest men in America were members of Kennedy's cabinet. And he himself knew all about how to use lofty rhetoric in a way almost worthy of the turn-of-the-century giants of political rhetoric. In his inaugural address, he'd said, "Ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country." An inspiring rhetorician. His actual accomplishments weren't so great, and it's easy to condemn his foreign policy as reckless, provoking the building of the Berlin Wall, escalating the war in Vietnam, bringing the world to the brink of war over the Cuban Missile Crisis, and so on. Historians already disagree, and surely will continue to disagree, over his legacy. Well, his vice president, Lyndon Johnson, was sworn into office on the plane back from Dallas to Washington, D.C. And there's a famous photograph of Johnson being inaugurated with the distraught Jackie Kennedy there on the plane with him. The Johnson administration continued and escalated the work that Kennedy had begun. Johnson came from a very, very different background than Kennedy. He came from humble Texas stock. His grandfather was one of the populists in the 1890s. And he was already a Washington veteran when Kennedy arrived on the scene. In the early 1930s, he'd been a congressman, a Texas congressman's aide. He was present at the creation of the New Deal organization, witnessed the rapid rise of the Washington establishment, and he ran one of the New Deal programs, the National Youth Administration, in Texas. He did a term in Congress before the Second World War, ran unsuccessfully for a Texas Senate seat in 1941, and then did a stint in the Navy like most of the rest of his contemporaries. Coming out of the service, he ran again for the U.S. Senate in 1948 and won, although his campaign was surrounded by allegations of fraud. And at first, he entered the U.S. Senate under a shadow of having got there by improper means. Nevertheless, he was a very effective politician and was re-elected in 1954 and became the Senate Majority Leader. So that by 1960, he was one of the most... he'd already got nearly 30 years of experience in Washington, was one of the savviest men in town. He was a candidate for the Democratic nomination, but was beaten out in the primaries by Kennedy, and instead was asked by Kennedy to come onto the ticket as vice president in order to shore up the South and Southwest as electoral areas, which Kennedy, a Massachusetts man, was relatively weak in. The two of them didn't get on very well, and Johnson certainly wasn't an insider in the Kennedy White House. Becoming president, especially under these circumstances of an assassination, he felt a little bit overshadowed by the mystique of the Kennedys, and Johnson himself was scorned by the Kennedy loyalists. Here's the historian Gary Wills in a great book called The Kennedy Imprisonment, in which he talks about the Kennedys and their influence. Wills says, "No sooner was President Kennedy dead than his followers began to think and speak of a restoration. Lyndon Johnson was, at best, an interlude. At worst, a usurper, intrusive in any case, out of the proper order of things. The loonier left tried to involve Johnson in the assassination itself. Others more vaguely blamed Texas for the president's death and made the Texan successor guilty by association. Awareness of these criticisms dulled the political instincts of Lyndon Johnson. A man as large as Paul Bunyan in the Senate, he'd been pre-shrunk in a White House where Kennedy aides snickered at him. And even when he came to power, he could take no revenge upon them. In fact, he had to woo them, ask for their help, try to maintain a continuity of authority. All the credit for his own initiatives in civil rights or the poverty program seemed to go to Kennedy. He was president only over the things that went wrong." Well, that's a very, very shrewd insight that Kennedy himself exercised an influence beyond his death, which had a not altogether positive effect on Johnson. In fact, his achievements were far greater than those of President Kennedy. He worked very, very long hours. He was engrossed in the legislative details. When necessary, he'd call recalcitrant congressmen into the White House and give them what was called the treatment, telling them anecdotes, browbeating them, cajoling and persuading them in various ways to vote right on the legislation he wanted. And the legislative achievements of Johnson were vastly superior to those of the Kennedy administration. In fact, altogether, his Congress has passed almost as much social legislation as had the first 100 days of Roosevelt's New Deal. He was an expert in congressional management, and of course, to have someone in the White House in that position is desirable. So it was he who ushered in the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, the Immigration Reform Act, which also has had immense and lasting consequences in really transforming the makeup of the American population up to the present. He won re-election handsomely in 1964 against a conservative Republican called Barry Goldwater. Goldwater was an Arizona senator and a millionaire. Goldwater's campaign slogan was, "A choice, not an echo." In other words, don't follow the Republican tendency to accept all the heritage of the New Deal. Goldwater's view was that it was time to roll back the New Deal order altogether and regain the old flinty sense of American independence, abolish the income tax, get rid of Social Security, roll back communism once and for all, sell off the Tennessee Valley Authority, big plans to annihilate the political transformations of the last 30 or 40 years. His loyalists had managed to launch a coup inside the Republican Party. So to the horror of the Republican regulars, people like Rockefeller, moderate and liberal Republicans, here was Goldwater transforming their party. His campaign slogan was, "In your heart, you know he's right." But others used to say, "In your guts, you know he's nuts." So anyway, strong feelings around Goldwater. And he was almost incredibly tactless in the way he ran the campaign. For example, he went to Tennessee and spoke boldly against the Tennessee Valley Authority, which was the employer of most of the people in his audience. He was in a retirement community in St. Petersburg, Florida, when he said, "Now it's time to abolish Social Security." So normally, candidates are, of course, exquisitely sensitive to the importance of not alienating voters' blocks and finding ways of getting 50% plus a bit more of the population to vote for them. Goldwater was much more interested in getting the ideas straight, whatever the price. So it's no wonder that Johnson won an overwhelming victory against him. Now, Goldwater alleged that Johnson was insufficiently resolute in opposing communism, and that was one of the contributing factors to Johnson's escalation of America's role in the Vietnam War after his re-election, which had very serious long-term consequences. His war on poverty programs, which were begun before his re-election and then accelerated afterwards, argued for the maximum feasible participation of the poor themselves. An important book published in 1962 was Michael Harrington's The Other America, which described the fact that 15 or 20% of the American population was being left out of the affluent society and ought not to be. Johnson read Harrington's book in 63 and was very, very impressed by it. He created a whole array of programs which were designed to address poverty root and branch and get rid of it once and for all. This extraordinary phrase, a war on poverty, which he said carried the same kind of moral imperative as an actual war would anywhere. Another influential social theorist of the time, Oscar Lewis, had popularized the idea of the culture of poverty, that there's something cultural about certain ways of life which tend to encourage and duplicate poverty. People who live very, very much in the present, who are incapable of saving, incapable of thinking ahead to the logic of being highly educated. The phrase was no deferred gratification. The lack of strong male role models, the way in which families which break down are much more likely to, the children are much more likely to become delinquent, the mothers to become poor, and so on. All these were the kinds of issues which the Johnson administration took on very seriously with programs like Head Start, the creation of a big Department of Housing and Urban Development, the VISTA program, the Peace Corps program, getting privileged young volunteers to work at home and abroad, correcting poverty, and so on. His hope was that this array of programs, all heavily funded from taxation, would be able to self-start a generation and gradually eliminate and displace the culture of poverty. Overcoming long-standing opposition from the American Medical Association, Congress also created Medicare and Medicaid, health insurance policies for the elderly and for the indigent. Well, all these policies appear to augur a great new future for America, but unfortunately, no sooner had they got underway than the inner-city race riots began, first in Watts in Los Angeles, and then spreading throughout the nation in the ensuing years. They very, very severely undercut the good feeling which had been generated by the civil rights movement, because the rioters were mainly black, and also began to cast doubt on the question of whether the war on poverty programs weren't themselves a little bit utopian, that they hadn't taken into consideration many of the actual social obstacles to such an ambitious program of getting rid of poverty once and for all. So very, very serious questions were left about whether the programs were viable. And as the 60s progressed, more and more American money and political energy was diverted into the Vietnam War, meaning that the social programs had to compete against this other war rather than be the sole focus of the government's administration. This pattern of difficulties eventually brought down Lyndon Johnson, as we'll see in a subsequent lecture.